Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome to another edition of News and Views, and thanks for joining us. Sunday marks the one-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of same-sex marriage nationwide. And a new study released by Gallup this week estimates that approximately 123,000 same-sex marriages have taken place since the court's landmark 2015 decision. Chris Brook with the ACLU of North Carolina joins us this week to talk about what has transpired since the high court's ruling, the ongoing battle for equality, and the push to repeal HB2. Well, Chris, thanks for being back with us on News and Views. Always good to see you.
Good to see you as well, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
A lot going on in the civil liberties world and human rights world these days in North Carolina and around the country. But before we get to what's happening this year, let's talk a little bit about the anniversary of a big day.
Yeah, so we are at the year anniversary of the Obergefell decision in which the Supreme Court recognized a right pursuant to the 14th Amendment for same-sex couples to get married. We'd already had same-sex marriage in North Carolina dating back to October of 2014. Really only a handful of states that did not have marriage with the Obergefell decision. But, you know, obviously it was exceptionally important in those states that did not yet have marriage equality for that decision to come down. Also exceptionally important from just a symbolic standpoint because it really did, in a lot of ways, serve as the culmination of a series of gay rights opinions from the Supreme Court establishing that treating the LGBT community as less than was going to be something that courts were going to look at with great skepticism. And that is a huge sea change since, for example, the Bowers v. Hardwick decision in 1986, in which the Supreme Court almost ridiculed the notion of same-sex relationships. So to realize that sort of change in really a generation is too long, but as a lawyer, you have to recognize that that's pretty quick progress.
It's interesting, too, for all the dire predictions about what was going to happen. It appears to me that folks are getting married. Folks are happily married. Some are not. It's just like a normal. The sky hasn't fallen.
Chris, I don't know what you're talking about. When I came in this morning from the parking lot, I fought off a series of zombies. Raleigh has turned into an absolute hellscape now that we have marriage equality. I mean... In a lot of ways, the reality is very mundane, and that's exactly what we predicted from the outset, which is that the impact for the vast majority of North Carolinians is not going to be anything. You know, we're going to go about our days and get married if we want to get married, not get married. But for the LGBT community, ensuring that they're not going to be treated as second-class citizens on a day-in, day-out basis and sort of had to wear that badge of inferiority that's been put upon them by the state of North Carolina is a huge deal, not only from a symbolic standpoint, but also from a very practical standpoint, being able to extend health insurance benefits to your spouse, to your partner. It's also hugely important for LGBT youth to be able to grow up in a North Carolina where they know that they're going to have the equal rights, equal right to marry who they love. And as the last year has shown us, the fight for true lived day-in, day-out LGBT equality is nowhere near won. But this is a huge advance, a huge mile marker in the progress that we've made and is something worth celebrating even as we recognize that the work's not done.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. That's sort of the good news. And now, but those same LGBT citizens can be fired from their jobs. They can be denied services. Transgender people are now literally being demonized. And we have HB2 in the wake of that. Where are we on that? And how do you make sense of sort of this battle for the larger good and LGBT rights overall?
So right after Obergefell, that was the thing that we always said. And you know, I sort of stole it from my friend Jen Jones, who was formerly at Equality North Carolina and is now at Democracy North Carolina, that you know, you get married on Sunday and then get fired from your job on Monday for having a photo of your wedding the day before. And that's an intolerable circumstance. And there needed to be state protections to guarantee that LGBT folks in the workplace were judged based on the content of their work as opposed to who they love. Unfortunately, the state has gone in the opposite direction, taking away the ability of localities via HB2 to protect the LGBT community in the employment context, in the public accommodations context, in the public facilities context. So, you know, there all civil rights struggles are different and all have some similarities. You know, we've seen similar backlash, and unfortunately similar backlash in the South to advances in civil rights around integration and desegregation last century. And I think we're seeing some of that as well. And I think we're seeing a fair amount of similar political opportunism from folks who have the levers of power in our state to distract folks from what the real issues are in our state by taking advantage of marginalized communities. I think the thing that's heartening about HB2, if we're looking for a silver lining, because it is not a good thing, obviously, it's really negatively impacting the LGBT community day in, day out in our state. But if we're looking for a good thing, the good thing is that there really has been a political outcry, and it's not been something that has been relegated to the Triangle and to the progressive community neighborhoods in Greensboro, or the progressive portions of Charlotte. There really has been a broad, and in a lot of ways across the ideological perspective, pushback against HB2, pushback against marginalizing the LGBT community, making that the priority, and bringing this sort of attention to our state. Whereas previously we've been sort of seen as a beacon in the South, we're now being lumped in repeatedly with Mississippi as one of the most anti-LGBT states in the United States. That's something that obviously troubles us as folks who care about civil liberties and civil rights. But it's also something that really troubles the business community, because they recognize that not only is this bad for our state's reputation, it's also bad for just the business bottom line of getting the best workers into the state of North Carolina. We need to be having everybody wanting to move to North Carolina, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of their gender identity. If they can do the job, we want them here in North Carolina, and that's what we've heard the business community largely say.
One more question about the HB2 world. What did you make of the Charlotte school decision recently, the way they're going to treat transgender kids, the decision by UNC President Spellings to, in effect, not enforce HB2 on university campuses? There does seem to be not only the outcry from the business community and human rights activists, but actually people who are running institutions who realize how ridiculous this is.
So I want to start with CMS, and then I want to turn to UNC, because there are a little bit of differences in the way that they've responded, although walking away from HB2 are telling in their own way. I think Charlotte very appropriately concluded, first and foremost, that their mission as a school district, the largest school district in the state of North Carolina, is to make sure that every student who comes in the door in the morning can succeed, and that means allowing transgender students to access bathroom facilities that comport with their gender identity. We've seen states and schools throughout the nation do this without any problems whatsoever, and in a way that supports all students. So first and foremost, they're just fulfilling their pedagogical mission of making sure everyone has an opportunity to succeed. So it's a courageous move, and we applaud them for that. It also, beyond being morally and ethically right, is right as a matter of law. The Fourth Circuit has now spoken very clearly in regards to this, saying that the Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX to prohibit discrimination based on gender identity and against transgender individuals merits deference and is now really the governing precedent here in North Carolina. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that. It just takes, you know, a Westlaw account in about 15 minutes. Unfortunately, our governor does not seem to have either of those things. So they looked at it and they said, listen, HB2 very clearly does not, flies right in the face of the recent Fourth Circuit decision and Department of Education guidance on point. What UNC has done is a little bit more nuanced, and I always welcome the opportunity to talk about this because it is more nuanced. What they've said is we're not enforcing it. I'm using scare quotes here. And then you look at President Spellings' declaration in support of that assertion, and she says we're not enforcing it, but then she references guidance that she issued to all of the campuses, that all of the campuses in turn promulgated to their students, that said we have to abide by HB2. And you have to utilize the restroom that reflects what's on your birth certificate. So what President Spellings is saying is essentially kind of a politer version of what the governor has been saying, which is they're not going to be bathroom police. You know, they're not going to be folks knocking down stall doors. Well, you know, thank you very much. But at the same time, that doesn't change the fact that they are saying that they are abiding by HB2. They're not doing what Charlotte is doing, which is looking at whether this comports with Title IX and whether the courts have held that this comports with Title IX. And, you know, whether they're enforcing it is irrelevant under Title IX. What Title IX prohibits is discrimination against transgender students. And they are still very clearly communicating to Joaquin, to Peyton, to Hunter, the UNC employees and students that we represent in our lawsuit, that they are less than on the UNC campus. Now, UNC saying they're not going to enforce it and being so public about that is a recognition that this is terrible for the state of North Carolina's reputation and for UNC's reputation. How many employees or prospective employees have withdrawn applications for working at UNC Chapel Hill? At NC State since HB2 has been passed. How many students have put down an application to Appalachian State or to UNC Asheville or UNC Greensboro because they just don't think that they're welcome in North Carolina after HB2? The answer is it's countless folks, and we're losing those talented people who can enrich our state.
Shifting gears in the couple minutes we have left, you were in Richmond this past week for arguments on the voting rights or voter suppression law that was passed by North Carolina, upheld by one federal judge. Now it was in the Fourth Circuit. Tell us, where do you think that case is headed?
Well, I think it's headed to, first and foremost, a relatively swift decision. You know, we are right now in June, not very far from the November election. The Fourth Circuit put this on an expedited briefing and hearing schedule because they clearly recognized that it would be best if they could issue a decision as far in advance of the election as possible. What I heard yesterday in the courtroom in Richmond was profound skepticism from all three of the judges on the Fourth Circuit panel. You had Judge Wynn talking about the fact that the North Carolina Senate had stripped out public benefits identification cards from something that could be a valid form of voter photo ID, asking the attorney for North Carolina why that would be the case. You had Judge Henry Floyd note that this decision, the decision to massively expand the voter suppression bill, immediately followed the Supreme Court eviscerating Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and Senator Tom Apodaca saying now we can go with the full bill, quote unquote. And he said, Judge Floyd said that looks really bad to me, and made it plain that what it looked like was that they were targeting African-American voters to try to realize partisan ends. And, Judge Motz was similarly disconcerted by the fact that this seemed to be a very clear partisan effort realized by making it harder, in particular on African-Americans, to vote. I think we'll have a decision in the case in weeks, not months. I think it's possible we could have a decision in July in this case. Never want to make predictions, but I'm cautiously optimistic based on what I heard. And I'm also cautiously optimistic based on the data that we were able to put out there. In 2014, when same-day registration had been eliminated, it's now back in place based on an injunction that we did obtain from the Fourth Circuit earlier. You had almost 13,000 North Carolinians who were turned away from voting based on the fact that they couldn't same-day register. You had nearly 1,500 folks in the 2014 election who were prevented from voting in out-of-precinct due to the elimination of out-of-precinct balloting. This most recent primary election in 2016, we saw the first implementation of the voter photo ID provisions, and it was an absolute disaster, where it took months to certify a low turnout election because people were handing the wrong ballots to folks who claimed a reasonable impediment. The reasonable impediment provisions were interpreted differently throughout the state. The chickens are coming home to roost in regards to the impacts that this bill is going to have. I think we've made that case very plain. Fourth Circuit's not necessarily the final word here. You know, the state of North Carolina could always appeal this to the Supreme Court. You know, I think the record is pretty compelling. I think that the Fourth Circuit is likely to have the last word here, at least in the short term for the 2016 election. I'm cautiously optimistic about that.
Well, thank you very much for bringing us up to date, and thanks for all you're doing. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Coming up, we'll discuss the need to expand Medicaid and keep the AIDS Drug Assistance Program fully funded. Stay with us.